This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
About the Shabbaton that we were planning, and the fact that we're using that also as a bit of a celebration of the 18th anniversary of the Beis HaMedrash, as well as the fact that we were going to try and use that opportunity to do some fundraising for the Beis HaMedrash. So in addition to your opportunity this evening of picking up an invitation to the Shabbaton, which are available, some of you have received them already, some of you have not, and if you wish to have an invitation, if you'll please check up front on your way out and take one. And also, one of the fundraising techniques that we're using, is the theme of the Shabbaton is Go for Gold, which means what we'll be talking about is how to utilize and benefit from the gold that exists in the human resources of this country, both Jewish and non-Jewish. And we're asking people to subscribe to a gold bar in the very beautiful magazine that we're going to be producing, which will be widely distributed not only among Jewish people but also among non-Jewish people. And the cost of a gold bar is 54 Rand. I'm very grateful. After last year, one person came up and took 10 gold bars. He said, "What's another nought? It's nothing." And the 54 Rand is far too little for a gold bar. But there are other people for whom 54 Rand is a lot of money, so please don't feel restricted to only taking one. There's nothing at all wrong in taking 10 or 100, that's also okay, but we certainly wish to use that as a way of covering a large portion of the budget for the Shabbaton. So there's a form, I think, going around in front of you, and whoever can manage to participate in this program, I would appreciate them doing so. It's one of the, somebody mentioned to me, discussing after shul this morning, it's educationally bad. It's, from a PR point of view, it's good, but educationally it's not correct that people have become accustomed in this country not to pay for their Torah. People have become accustomed here to get it free. And particularly in the Baal Tshuva movement, the parents of this generation used to pay for their Torah. They used to belong to shuls, they used to build shuls. And you see all the shuls that we've got all over the country, sometimes built by very small communities. A small group of people would get together and would build a shul that cost a lot of money, and they could ill afford it. And they used to buy Sifrei Torah, and they used to employ a rov, a shochet, and a teacher. Sometimes two of the three were combined in one, but a small band of people, 20, 30 families, struggling for a living, still with family in Europe that they were trying to bring out, running around from Sunday till Friday in the country selling their wares. Those are the kind of people who invested fortunes of money for them in putting up shuls, mikvehs, chadorim, bringing out Sifrei Torah, bringing out rabbonim, reverends, teachers, shochtim. That's what they used to do. The Baal Tshuva movement has become accustomed to getting it for nothing. Which means you go to Keter Torah, or you go to Osamach, or you go to the Kolo, and let the rabbonim raise the money, let them be the shnorers. That educationally isn't right. If one's benefiting from a place, one supports a place, you keep a place going, and it's not the custom here to levy a charge for a shir. But it used to be the custom. Remember, Hillel was a very poor man and an outstanding Talmud, and one day he didn't have enough money to come into the Beis HaMedrash. They didn't say to him, "Well, it doesn't matter, Hillel, for you it's an honor for us to have you. Why don't you come right in?" Imagine Hillel would knock at the door now, or the Rambam, or the Vilna Gaon, or Rabbi Akiva would knock at the door. Say, sorry, there's a fee, you can't afford it, that's it. And it was a miserably cold day, you remember, colder than tonight. And Hillel went and sat listened from the top. And the snow, remember, the snow covered him in, and Shmai and Aftalion saw him and brought him in eventually when they saw what Mesiris Nefesh he had. But there was no question about admitting him without the fee. Somebody has to pay for Torah. Who are the people that must pay for it? The people who are benefiting from it. So when I ask you to take a gold bar for 54 Rand, I would like you to bear in mind the hours and hours that I've spent preparing the Shiurim, from which many of you have benefited. That's not a hard sell, it's just... in addition, by the way, it would help us very much if you sold a few extra gold bars among the people that you know. Not a lot of money, and a lot of people are very, very happy to do it. And it's not an ongoing stop order, it's a one-off thing. It would be very nice if you took a few extra sheets on your way out and got your friends and relations to also help out on that. It would make a very big difference to us. And that way we're able to support what goes on and to develop and produce more and more Torah. This evening we're going to deal with a bit before that, by the way, something quite interesting. Those of you who were here last week, I'm told that as a result of last week, it's nice to hear that sometimes there's some practical results. A couple who've been going out for years decided to get engaged after last week's shiur. I thought it was enough of this going out, and I'm told it was as a I don't even know the couple, mazel tov to them, but I'm told it was a direct result of the shiur. This evening we're going to have a look at the Meraglim, the spies, and what went wrong with the whole exercise. It's an exercise that went horribly wrong. An exercise that, as the Ramban points out, and Mr. Dratman pointed out this morning in his talk at the Kiddush, an exercise which essentially was not a bad idea, to send spies to go and see the land before you conquer it. It's something that Yeshua did later on. It's something that was done often. It was the normal way of fighting a war. And since they were fighting a normal war, although they had Hashem behind them, they were fighting with normal weapons, and they were going about it in an apparently normal sort of way. One of the exercises of warfare is to send spies ahead of time to work out which is the safest route to take. There doesn't seem to be anything inherently wrong with the exercise, and yet Hashem wasn't too pleased with it, and it went horribly wrong, resulting in the annihilation of an entire generation of Jews. Now imagine what we would have had to say had somebody else, a non-Jew, been responsible for the annihilation of an entire generation of Jews. We would have a lot to say about him. And here these 12 people, or 10 of the 12 people, were responsible because of this horrible tragedy, things just getting right out of hand, for the annihilation of a generation of Jews who were prevented from coming into Eretz Israel, who had to live out the rest of their days in the desert and weren't able to come into Eretz Israel because of this strange exercise that went so terribly wrong. What happened? Why did it go so wrong? And who were these people after all? The Ramban says that they're mentioned in order of greatness. That means that the greatest of them was a man called Shamua ben Zakur. Anybody heard of him before? He was the greatest. We haven't even heard of him. Next was Shofat ben Khairi, the second greatest. Third was Kolev ben Yefune. Fourth was Yigal ben Yosef. All of them names except for Kolev that we don't know. Fifth was Yoshua. Now we do know Yoshua and we know how great he was. He was Moshe's successor. But he was the fifth. That means there were four people even greater than Yoshua. That's how great these people were. And it's interesting to realize how great the whole nation was. The Baal HaTurim says that these 12 people were all Sorei Chamishim. They were all in charge of communities of 50 people. It was the size of the community of each of these Rabbonim. But we know, says, if we make the calculation, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz makes it a few times, that means there were another 18,000 on the same level. And there were, I think he says, well, we can work it out, 6,000 who each had communities of 100. Well, you know, it was a pyramid sort of structure. So you had a rabbi who was in charge of two junior rabbonim. Each junior rabbi was in charge of 50 people and he was in charge of 100 people. So there were 1,000 people, is that right? 6,000 people. No, there were 6,000 people above these. There were 18,000 on the same level. 6,000 even greater than them. And so it goes up. There were thousands and thousands of people that were greater than these 12. So one gets some kind of an idea of the stature of the Jewish people at that time. And these people were all of the stature of Yoshua. There were 18,000 people who were potential successors to Moshe Rabbeinu. That's how great they were. And yet it went horribly wrong. And if a seemingly innocent and correct exercise can go so horribly wrong when carried out by such great people, what happens when we set about doing things? What chance have we got of getting it right? So it's important for us to try and understand what went wrong. And there's pages and pages, volumes and volumes of discussion as to what went wrong. We've got to try and find some kind of an approach through it. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz asks another fascinating question. He says, these 12 people, again, the 10 of the 12 people who went spying, they became scared. And they believed that they weren't going to, that the Jewish people were not going to be able to win the war against the Canaanites. And that made them feel very negative and very pessimistic, which means they lost their confidence in the Ribbono Shel Olam. So much so, in fact, that when they say, Ki chazok hu mimenu, this nation is greater than us. Chazal learned that the way they pronounced that was not that they were greater than mimenu, than us, but mimeno, greater than Hashem. There is such force there, there is such strength there, that there's no way that even God will be able to overcome these people. They lost their trust in God. Later on, Yeshua sends two spies into Eretz Israel. We read it in the Haftarah today. And an ordinary woman, a non-Jewish innkeeper in Yericho, who's had no contact with Torah, no contact with Rabbonim, no contact with Gedolei Israel, nothing. All she's had is the newspaper reports of this nation going through the desert. So she's heard about what's happened. And she says to them when they get talking, Yodati kinosan Hashem lochem es haoretz. I know that God has given you the land. Asub Chaim Shmulevitz, now I ask you, this non-Jewish innkeeper living in Yericho, she knows that Hashem has given the land to them. And these 10 great men, all of them around the statue of Yoshua bin Nun, are not sure of that. They've seen the Red Sea, they saw the 10 plagues, they saw Yitzias Mitzrayim, they saw the Red Sea split, they saw the Mon, they saw the Matan Torah, they saw the Slav, they saw the water, all these things they've seen, they've been exposed to. She didn't see any of that. She knows that Hashem is going to win the war. She knows that they're going to conquer the land. And they who have actually experienced all of this at first hand, they're in doubt. They're not quite sure. How is that possible? What value is all that experience if it leaves them in doubt when a non-Jewish lady who lives in Yericho is able to have absolute faith and confidence in the ability of the Ribbono Shel Olam to bring these people to Eretz Israel? And Reb Chaim answers that the difference between Rochav and these 10 people is not that Rochav was on a higher level than them. Of course she wasn't. They were on a much higher level than Rochav. But what's important when you look at levels, says Reb Chaim, is not the level but the gradient. What's important is the direction. Are you moving up or are you moving down? Anybody would rather invest in a very small company that's moving up than in the, what's important is not where you are, what's important is where you're going. When you decide on the future, you've got to look at the direction of things, not the status of things. The status is irrelevant. You've got to look at a long view and see what's the direction. Is there a movement up or is there a movement down? These 10 people were moving down. Their peak was at Sinai. And since then they've been on their way down. Rochav is down at the bottom. But she's building herself up. She hears about what Hashem has done. She hears about the miracles. Each thing she hears strengthens her faith. So they're in a mode of decreasing faith, but they're still miles above Rochav. But the mode is one of deterioration, whereas Rochav is one of increase. Rochav is a person who's on her way up. And that's very important, that one's view of the world, not only one's view of the world, but the Chiddush of Reb Chaim is your view of God changes in accordance with whether you're on the way up or you're on the way down. Your view of everything changes. And we discussed last night, and we'll be discussing, and last Saturday night, and we'll be discussing again this evening, of the extent to which the approach that you adopt to something determines the way you see it, and the way you interpret it, and the way you understand it. And there are various elements that constitute the way you approach something, the attitude with which you approach something. Last week we talked about the way a thing is presented to you. That determines, and last night as well, the way a thing is introduced to you. That's going to determine the way you approach it. Another element in the way you approach it, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, is whether you're on the way up or you're on the way down. That's what's important. If people in South Africa at the moment would adopt the view, yeah, things are rough, but they're going to get better. Maybe we'll go, there'll be a period of it still being worse. We're not over the worst yet necessarily. Might get a little bit bumpier still. But generally we're on the way up. We see a future. Things are going in the right way. People would get very cheerful. People would be very optimistic. People would be investing. They would look at things differently. It's not important where you are. What's important is where you're going. And that's what one has to look when one's looking at any situation. One has to be able to, within oneself, always, be in an upward movement, be in a situation of growth. when you are growing, you look at the world in a completely different way to the way you look at the world when you are not growing. And I've watched that and I've analyzed that with people all over the world. People who are not growing are negative about everything. People who are growing are positive about everything. That doesn't mean they're not realistic, but one can be realistic from a positive standpoint and one can be realistic from a negative standpoint. And people who are growing are positive in everything they understand, in everything they look at. They see the possibility and the potential of the positive side and they focus on that and develop that. And they project positivism and they become successful. And people who are not in a growth phase, they're stagnating or they're deteriorating. It makes no difference where they live or what profession they're involved in. They're in a deteriorating mode and they're in a small-minded mode and they see the negative and they become self-destructive, never mind destructive to everybody else. And so Rachav was in a growth mode, whereas these people were not in a growth mode. What I want to do this evening is to try and understand what happened to them. Why weren't they in a growth mode? What was the terrible thing that caused them to go into the state of decline, resulting in a diminishment of their appreciation of the value of the Ribbono Shel Olam, of God Himself? Some people think it doesn't matter if you're negative, you can still have emuna. It doesn't work like that. A negative person is negative about everything, including God. A person's negative when you talk to somebody and he comes over negative. Don't think that he can be positive about God. He's negative about everything, including God. Nothing's any good. Nobody's any good. Nothing will ever be any good. Everything's bad, except the only thing that's good for a negative person is the grass on the other side of the fence. That's always wonderful. That's always tremendous. But everything else is useless. And of course, when he gets to the other side, nothing changes. And the grass gets greener on some other side of the fence. And he spends his life jumping over fences or striving to jump over fences without really going anywhere. Going round and round in circles. One of the things they say, the spies say when they come back is, "Unehi be'einenu kechagovim," and we considered ourselves in our own eyes, we felt like locusts. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, on that that you said that you felt like locusts, Bitati Alehim, says God, I've excused them for that statement, that they felt like locusts. Elo v'chein ha'yinu be'enehem. That says the Medrash, Hashem says, when they said, and they thought of us as locusts, then I get angry, says Hashem. Yodim ha'yisim me'asisi eschem le'enehem. Do you know what perspective I gave to them of you? That you felt like a locust. Good, okay, vitati. Notice the Medrash says, vitati, I excuse them. Which means it was wrong, they had no right to feel like that. It was an incorrect feeling. But what can I do? I feel like locusts. But to say that they saw us as locusts, that's what they saw. How do you know what somebody else sees you as? How do you know what other people think of you? What right have you got to do to make assumptions about how others think of you? With Rachav we find nothing of that. With Rachav we find amazing self-confidence and self-esteem. I know that Hashem has given you the land. We've heard what Hashem has done for you and how you did that and so on. And then she starts making a deal. I want an oath from you. I've done a chesed for you. Now you've got to do a chesed for me and with my family. And you've got to keep us alive. She enters into negotiations with these great people who've come to spy. No terror and fear. She lays down, she makes a deal with them. Absolute self-esteem. She doesn't say to herself, these great rabbis, I'm just a non-Jewish woman, a hotel owner in Yericho, they won't take any notice of me. Not at all. She starts dealing with them, discussing with them, explaining to them, goes into her own understanding of emunah, of what Hashem's doing and where it's going to lead to, and what the ultimate is going to be, how it's going to affect her and her family. She enters into negotiations with them and she makes a deal with them. A very sophisticated, self-confident young lady. Not so the spies. The hayinu be'enenu kechagovim. We thought of ourselves as locusts. And that's how they thought of us too. Says Hashem, you had no right to think of yourselves as locusts. And you certainly had no right to assume that they thought of you as locusts. And here we see one of the aspects leading to their decline. What brought them into this mode of decline? Their own negative self-image. The fact that they believed so little in themselves, and even less in how they're projecting themselves to others. These are great people. These are all potential Yehoshuas. These are all potential leaders of nations. These are all potential generals of armies. These are all potential Nevi'im, prophets. They're great people. What right have you got to be so low in self-esteem? To consider yourself like a locust and to assume that that's how other people consider you, that you don't have the right to do. And that we begin to see that decline taking place already here. But we need to dig a little deeper to try and understand what is it then that led them to that low self-image, to that low level of self-esteem. What's interesting to note also is, by the way, something that I often say but one doesn't see such a clear illustration of it, is that the low esteem syndrome is something that is irrespective of where the person is. You can have a person that you would think certainly doesn't suffer from low self-esteem. He's the President of the United States, or she's the Queen of England, or whatever. Doesn't mean a thing. Low self-esteem is an illness that strikes people at all levels. Makes absolutely no difference. It's a terribly destructive force. It's wrong to call it an illness, because an illness signifies something that is beyond your control, something that comes from outside. Self-esteem is self-generated. It's brought upon by yourself. It's nourished and nurtured by yourself. Nobody else is responsible for it, and only you can get yourself out of it. And you're held responsible for it. That's how Hashem holds them responsible. Bad enough that you feel little, that you feel yourselves to be little. But what right have you got to assume that other people regard you as small? You don't know how I introduced you to them. You don't know what ideas I put in their minds about who you really are. How can you assume you're nobody? But where does this come from, this low self-esteem? There's an interesting discrepancy in the use of the words in this Sedra and in the words used in Devarim, where Moshe recounts what actually happened. And remember, in Devarim, Moshe is giving them Musa. Moshe chastises them for the various things that went wrong during their sojourn in the desert. And he says, Vatikravun Elai Kulchem, and you all gathered up against me, you all came to me, Batoimru, and you said, Nishlecho Anoshim Lefoneinu, let us send men before us. Now, I showed you last night in the Medrash that whatever went wrong, Chazal in this particular Medrash attributes to the initial sending of the people. Because you'll remember the Medrash said, you've asked to send people, what can I do? If I say, no, you can't send people, you'll suspect that I'm withholding information from you. So I've got to let you send people. But I swear that none of those people or this generation will see Eretz Yisrael. But we know that came later. That wasn't when they asked to send spies. We explained last night that it's right that it came later, but the root of it was when they asked. So there was something wrong in that. Rambam says that also later on. There was something wrong in their initial request to send spies. And that's what the Rambam questions. What's wrong to want to send spies? What's the terrible thing? So Moshe recounts it in volume, and he says, you came to me and you said, Nishlecho anoshim lefoneinu ve'yachperu lonu es ha'oretz, and let them spy out the land. But the word used for spy here is ve'yachperu, which literally means let them dig in the land. Ve'yachperu, let them dig the land out. In our Sedra, that word never appears. In our Sedra, the word is Shelach lecho anoshim, send. Hashem says to Moshe, okay, send the people. Ve'yosuru Eretz Kanaan, and let them spy the land of Canaan. But the word used is ve'yosuru, different word. So they ask for people to be chofer the Oretz. Difficult in English because we've only got the one word, but in Hebrew there are these differences. They ask for people to be chofer the land, and Hashem says, I'm happy that you send people, but not to be chofer the land, to be tar the land. We have to understand the difference, because here is where the essence of the misunderstanding arises. They had a particular mission in mind. Hashem says, that not. Something else you can do. And then we'll analyze which of the two did they actually do. What's the difference between lachpo and losu? Lachpo, as we said, means to dig. Dig means to go beneath the surface. To dig, you try and uncover the hidden treasures. That's what it is, to dig out. Go and dig into it and investigate and uncover and unearth, understand really the depth of what this land is all about. How the people think, how the people operate, what's it all about? Get to the bottom of it. And that's what they wanted to do. Nishlecho anoshim lefoneinu, let us send people before us. Ve'yachperu lo nesoret, let them investigate the land. Deep investigation, let them really get to the bottom, to the essence of everything. Hashem says, no. You can go, you can send people. Ve'yosuru esoret, What does that mean? The Yosuru is like tayar. It means to tour the land. They can tour the land. That's all. There's a very big difference between investigating and touring. We need to understand the difference. Another word that's used in our parasha is leragel. We call them the meraglim. Meraglim, spies, comes from the word regel. You can walk around. A tourist explores. A chofer investigates. There's a difference between investigating and touring. When people go touring in Eretz Israel, they come back very, very excited and thrilled, and they want to emigrate. When they go on a pilot investigative tour, they get a little bit not so sure anymore. It's a different kind of tour with a different kind of purpose, and the things don't look quite the same. And when they go and live there, it looks completely different. But it's not just for Israel, it applies for everywhere. Why? What is the difference? Chofer, let's look at that word in its literal sense, to dig. And picture the scene of somebody digging in order to uncover what's beneath the ground. Take a gold mine. So you have miners go down kilometers under the ground and they dig. How much involvement is there in what they're really doing? Virtually zero. It's a mechanical exercise. They go down with their machines and their tools and they drill and they dig until their time's up. They go and they get their paycheck and they go home. Digging is a mechanical, so you may picture somebody with a shovel. Digging is one of the most mechanical activities you can think of. If I asked you to draw a little sketch of a person doing something very mechanical, very often people will draw the person digging a hole. It's just something you're not involved in at all. Touring, exactly the opposite. Person, you see a tourist, he's happy, he's emotionally involved, he's excited, he's looking at it. It's a different thing. There's a tremendous amount of involvement involved in it. These two words, apparently subtle but not so subtle, in the completely different attitudes to the exercise that they convey. The Yachperu, what they demanded was, we want to go and we want to dig out to understand really what's underneath it, what's behind it, what's beneath the surface. That's what we want to do. But implied in it, they might not have recognized that, but implied in that word is mechanically, objectively, coldly, analytically. And what does it mean when you tell somebody, when you come all excited to somebody with an idea? It might be an entrepreneur who comes to his bank manager all excited with a wonderful idea. We'll bring this from this country and this from this country, and we'll set up a factory in this country, and we'll be able to manufacture, and it will cost us 25% less than manufacturing in this country, and the transport will only cost us an extra 2%. We'll ship it to that country, we'll market it, and he's so excited. And the bank manager sits there with a blank face and he says, let me see your cash flow projection, let's study the figures. And he's already, the entrepreneur is already ready to walk out. Why? What's happened? What is the bank manager saying? You're all enthusiastic, that's fine. But it doesn't mean anything to me. I don't buy that. Show me the bottom line. What does it mean when Klal Yisrael say to Hashem, yes, this wonderful land you're talking about, and we're going to go and we're going to conquer it, and we're going to have a wonderful time there. Yachpuru, let's go and have a look at the bottom line. Let's go and see their financial situation. Let's go and examine industry there. Let's see employment possibilities there. Let's just have a look. We'll have a look coldly and analytically. We'll take our accountants along, and we'll take our scientists along, and we'll, from a distance, we'll analyze the cost benefits of the exercise of conquering Eretz Yisrael. That's the undermining of the Ribbono Shel Olam that took place. And Hashem says you can go, but as tourists. What's the function of tourists? When you send a person on a tour, you say, have a good time. If a person goes on an exploratory mission, he's going overseas on business, he's going to look at a risky investment, you don't say, have a good time. You say, I hope you're successful. I hope you come back. Be very careful. Look very carefully. Keep your eyes open. Don't let anything go past you. Analyze carefully. And I look forward to hearing what you come back with. When a person says, I'm going on holiday, you say, have a good time. Enjoy. What's the difference? Losur is the tayar, he goes, Laragel, he walks through the place. It's terribly superficial. But it's energetic, he enjoys it. There's emotion involved. He goes to have a good time. He doesn't notice the unemployment figures. He doesn't notice the crime figures. He doesn't notice where the industries are failing or they're not failing. He doesn't look at the stock exchange. Nothing. He just goes and he sits in the sun by the swimming pool and he goes on tours and he looks at buildings and he goes to museums and he eats in restaurants and he meets people and talks to people. And he comes back very enthusiastic. He had a wonderful time. Now, why does Hashem want 12 people to go on a tour of Israel? Why does he allow them to go, the 12 people, on a tour of Israel? Because he wants them to come back and tell everybody else what a wonderful time they had. That's all he wants. Go and enjoy yourselves. Go to Latayu, go on the Tiyu, and enjoy yourselves. Have a wonderful time. And come back to Bnei Israel and tell them, share that wonderful time with them. Infuse them with the wonderful time that you had over there. Let them share that enjoyment. Of course, that doesn't signify what the country's really like. But you don't have to worry what the country's really like. I'm telling you, says God, who knows better what the country's really like? There's no point in you going to investigate. I've done the investigation already, says Hashem, and there can be no better investigator than me, because I see beneath the surface. You don't have to look beneath the surface. Your desire to look beneath the surface shows that you don't trust me. But there is a certain value in your going. If you don't look beneath the surface, because when you start looking beneath the surface, you get depressed in any country. If you start looking beneath the surface, wherever you go, the person can come back from the most wonderful holiday. But if he goes there to look at the possibilities of emigrating and he looks seriously, you can get very depressed very quickly in any country. Going to Toronto, look at the weather. If you're going to London, look at the industry, look at the employment. If you're going to Israel, look at the military situation. There's hardly anywhere you can go where if you're going coldly and analytically, you won't find enough to depress you. So it says Hashem, don't go there analytically. You'll get depressed. I know it's a good land. I know it has potential. I know you'll do well there. And I'm telling you that, says Hashem. You don't have to go there to be chayfer. You have to go there letayer. You have to go there to have a pleasant time. Look around it superficially. Get excited. And come back and tell everybody else what a wonderful time you had. That's all that's important. We discussed last week that the superficial interaction is the point at which emotional bond is created. It's through surface interaction that a bond can be created, that an emotional bond can be created. It's not through depth that an emotional bond, an intellectual bond can be created through depth. But an emotional bond is created by the superficial things. When we talked about presentation, how you present something, that's its surface. How you package something, that's its outer layer. That doesn't matter. It's that presentation which determines the emotions with which you open the package. If it's beautifully packaged, you open it with joy. If you open it with joy, you will find pleasure in it. If you open it like an accountant, you will not find pleasure in it, even if it's a diamond. It might be a 5-carat diamond. You'll take out your loop and you'll examine it. And, oh, you'll find a little pintle of a flaw inside it. You'll find something to diminish it with. You'll find something to say that it's not really worth quite as much as it is, if that's how you look at it. But if you open it like a young lady getting it as a present, you'll enjoy it no matter what it is. It's terribly important that we approach things with that correct introduction, with that correct mindset, that we approach things determined to enjoy them. Terribly important. Even hard things have to be approached that way. Kol Shchein, good things have to be approached that way. Terribly important that we approach our Shabbos with that kind of attitude. If we approach Shabbos, oh, it's Shabbos again. What are the chances of enjoying it? If we approach a Yom Tov like that, Pesach coming again. What I've got to do, what chances they have of enjoying Pesach? Pesach Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. If we approach a Shir like that, and it's the same with material things. When we're meeting somebody, you're going out to spend an evening with somebody. Sometimes you do it because you want to do it, then it's easy. Sometimes you're doing it because you have to do it. But package it nicely. In a way where you look forward to it, in the way where you make it a special experience. And you'll find plenty to enjoy. That doesn't mean that we have to be naive and that we mustn't realize the flaws in things too. One sees the flaws as well. But we don't allow the flaw to spoil the whole. We don't allow the imperfection to deny us the enjoyment of the complete thing. So it's got a flaw, so what? When I was talking about presentation last week, and particularly in men-women relationships, it applies there so clearly. Applies there so obviously, and we touched on it last week. If there's not the correct introduction, boy meets girl, what are they looking at each other? To figure out what's wrong with him, what's wrong with her. Now he's got a slight squint, and she, funny shaped nose. Okay, maybe I can live with that. But the tone of her voice, and then she looks at him, and the way he holds his knife and fork, I don't know if I can. By the time the evening's over, they've each collected a list of imperfections, but they would be meshuggah to see each other again. But what happens if you say to the boy and the girl each way, I got somebody for you to meet. I have spent 6 weeks persuading her to meet with you. And you tell her, I have spent 6 weeks persuading him to meet with you. He didn't want to have anything to do with you. He is so special. She is so special. He is so wonderful. She is so wonderful. Now don't mess it up and look your best and behave your best and do your best. And you come now expecting this. What do you look for? Start trying to figure out what are these wonderful things that this person was talking about. And you look, it must be the shape of her nose. Look how unique it is. And she looks at him, it must be the way he holds his knife and fork. So individualistic. Ah, it's beautiful. Or the same things just look completely different. Why? Because there's been a bit of presentation. We're human beings, we're people, we're not things. We're not accountants, some of us. Terribly important to understand that at the end of the day, what determines success in anything that we do is enthusiasm. There's nothing else that does it. And enthusiasm means belief in the value of what you're doing. And you get that from the way you prepare yourself for what you're doing, not from the thing itself. We see that also in the... It's not coincidental that in the last parasha of the Seder, the last paragraph of the Shema is inserted at that point. And that one of the words that crops up there is, and you should have the tzitzis and look at them, remember the mitzvahs of Hashem, mind you, by looking at them. Just visual. See the tzitzis and you'll remember the mitzvahs and you'll do them. The loy sosuru, same word, and you won't go twirring, acharei levavchem v'acharei enechem, following your heart and your eyes. Cut out the twirring, says Rashi, what twirring? Kemoi misur horetz, the same word that we've got in the parashas of the Meraglim. There's a connection. Halev v'hainayim heim Meraglim laguf. The heart and the eyes are the spies, the tourists of the guf, of the body. And they present the Averis. Present. That's the word Rashi uses. They are the Shatchan. Ah, how good this will be. Body, have you got a chance to enjoy yourself? Ah, do you know what I saw? Do you know what I smelt? Do you know what I heard? Go and have a look. The eyes and the heart present the Averis in a way that make them so attractive. Imagine if we presented Averis as they really are. Here's the success. Each person has got his own Yetzirah. To eat treif, to be mechalel Shabbos, to do something with a lady that he's not supposed to be doing or that she's not supposed to be doing. Imagine if we presented it in the right way. Go and do it. You'll have a moment of sort of superficial pleasure. And let me now describe to you what's in Olam Haba, what will be waiting for you. Now, why don't you go and do it? That's one way of suggesting an aveira to somebody else. And the other way is, is this an opportunity? Can you enjoy yourself? It doesn't matter. Once in a lifetime you get an opportunity like this. No, Navera, okay, Hashem understands, and excuse you, Yetzirah, you'll do tshuva, Yom Kippur's coming, don't worry too much. Different ways. Same Avera. The way you present it will determine whether you go ahead with it or not. Who is the arch presenter? The eyes and the heart. How does it work? What's the mechanism, explains Rashi. Ha'ayin roya, the eye sees. What does it see exactly? This is not the brain seeing, this is the eye seeing. The eye can only see the wrapping. The eye can only see the packaging, it can't see beyond that. But for introduction, that's all you need. For presentation and for marketing, that's all you need, the packaging. Ha'ayin roya, the eye sees. V'halev chomed. And then the emotions become active. The heart wants. It's not an intellectual process. Making somebody want something is a superficial, very simple process of correct presentation. That's all it is. Make it look attractive and it will be attractive. Make it look delicious and it will be delicious. And somebody will want it. That's how the body works. That's how the Yetzirah works. You look at it and it looks good. That's all you need. If it looks good, I want it. Once you want it, then the body goes and does it. That's the negative form of motivation, and positive motivation works exactly the same. Make something look good. Make yourself look good too. That's the important part. Make the Torah look good. Make a Shir look good. Make a Beis HaMedrash look good. The way you present it to people is going to determine whether people want it or they don't want it. The fault is not in the person, and the fault is not in the object. If you're talking to somebody and trying to persuade him to come to a shir on a Motzei Shabbos, and he says, yeah, leave me alone. That's not because the shir is no good necessarily. And that's not because he's no good. It's because you're no good in the way you've presented it. That's all it is. It's possible to make anybody want anything if it's presented correctly. Understanding the person, what turns him on, what he likes, the way you present it, that's the way we need to communicate. If you want to make him, if you don't want to make him come, then don't start talking to him in the first place. But if you've decided that he's a target for a shir, or for your product, or for Yiddishkeit, or as a shidduch for your daughter, whatever the story is, if you want him to want it, present it in the proper way, and he will want it. Simple as that. That doesn't mean it will work. That doesn't mean he will necessarily come, or buy your product, or marry your daughter, and live happily ever after. But at least there's a chance. At least there's a chance. Without that, there's no chance whatever. Absolutely no chance. And that's what Hashem wants from the Meraglim. Just go and have a good time. Get enthusiastic about Eretz Yisrael. That's all I want you to sell. I don't need you to sell Eretz Yisrael. I'll do that. I just need you to sell enthusiasm. That's all you need. I need you to sell excitement. That's all. To make people want to go. That's all. Once they want to go, I'll do the rest, says Hashem. That's your responsibility. They didn't. They went. And they started analyzing deeply. Look at the people, how strong they are. Why are they so strong? How are we going to be able to conquer them? Look at the cities, how fortified they are. How are we going to handle this? They started analyzing. Strategists, army generals, accountants, industrialists, working out, not intuitively, analyzing the object. The object is Eretz Yisrael. And they are analyzing the strengths and the weaknesses of this object coldly and clinically. Now what happens when you analyze something coldly and clinically? As we said, the first thing that happens is you see its defects. Fine? Okay. But you see its power also. You're analyzing something powerful. The world is powerful. Eretz Yisrael is powerful. Objects, things around us, there are forces around us that are extremely powerful. If we stop to think coldly and analytically about South Africa, what are the chances of success? Zero. Zero. Coldly and analytically, how many uneducated people are there? How many unemployed people are there? What chance is there of getting the economy right? And if the economy isn't right, what chance is there of getting the politics right? Zero chance. So we want to emigrate. So now we think coldly and analytically about the United States. We look at the size of their budget. We look at their unemployed. We look at their drug addiction. We look at all sorts of things. That's not a place to go to. It has no future. So we look at Eretz Yisrael. How many 150 million Arabs? Around 3 million Jews. Look at that coldly and analytically. Look, as we said at Chalashudas today, now, Jews being killed every day in Eretz Yisrael. Every single day. Another person being killed, two people killed, one person killed, three people. Every single day. That a place to go. Awesome. So where are you going to go? When you look at something coldly and analytically, you become absorbed in the enormity of the object and the hopelessness of the little person. You look at the world, if you study science analytically, you study economics analytically, you study geography, whatever you want to study analytically. If you study it analytically, the object becomes bigger and bigger, and the subject becomes smaller and smaller. I get smaller and the thing gets bigger. And it induces fear and panic. A tourist doesn't feel that. A tourist goes, he gets excited, he doesn't feel overwhelmed. He doesn't feel he can't cope. He feels fine, everything's wonderful, it's good, it's a tremendous country. He's happy. Why? Just because he's been superficial? No. It's because he has involved something of himself in the process. He's allowed his emotions to operate. He's allowed his spirit to operate. He's judging intuitively, he speaks to people and he gets a feel of the way people feel in that country. That's what he uses. The tourist is using something of himself. And that's why five different tourists who went on the same tour will each come back with a different story of what their experience meant to them. Five different accountants go and look at the same prospect, they'll each come back with exactly the same story. It'll be written down, everything will clear, to the penny it'll be exactly the same. There'll be no deviation. Get five different engineers to look at a project, you'll get an engineering report, the five of them will be perfectly precise, exactly the same. Get five, those same people go as tourists, and they talk to you completely differently, as if the five of them have been to completely different countries. The country is the same, the person is different. They've allowed something of themselves to operate in their understanding of the object. And what happens when you allow something of yourself to operate in the understanding of the object? You're allowing a unique perspective to be seen. You're allowing yourself to look at it the way nobody else looks at it. You're allowing yourself to look at it the way only you look at it. And that's a part of you which is godly that sees it that way. Things that can be duplicated, as we've said several times in the last little while, things that can be duplicated are material things, they're not spiritual things. Spiritual things are unique and cannot be duplicated. When you come back and you've got a unique perspective, you've used the spiritual part of you to no Ribbono Shel Olam, there's nothing unique, there's nothing human in the way you're doing, you're purely replicating. When you ask somebody what they feel about South Africa and they tell you the same thing that you hear from every single person, you can discount it totally. It has no originality, it has no meaning, it has no depth, it has no thought. And somebody gives you a new insight, positive or negative, it doesn't matter, but it's a new insight, a unique way of looking at it. Oh, that's a person who's thinking, that's a person who's using his own mind, that's a person who's incorporating his own personality. He's not just regurgitating what everybody else says. And the same applies in Torah. When you hear people repeating the same slogans of Torah and the same stuff just in different forms over and over again, you know that there's no uniqueness in that, you know there's no spirituality in that, you know there's no godliness in that. It's just the reproduction of standard formulas, photostated off a machine and regurgitated. That's all it is. It's only when a person applies something of himself to what he's learning, to what he's analyzing, and is able to find some kind of a unique perspective, that one gets an understanding that this is spiritual, that this is something that is generating, this is something that is new, this is something that is novel, this is something where the person is using some of his godliness in order to understand what he's doing. And that's the opportunity that Hashem mourns the missing of. I gave you an opportunity to send these 12 people as tourists. I gave them the opportunity to come back all excited, not able to report on the deep elements of the statistics and the figures and the industry and the strategic layout of the country. We don't need that because I'm leading you, says Hashem. But I wanted them to come back with the human side. Just to come back and say, it feels good there. It feels good. We had a good time. It was nice to be there. And we'll share with you some of the niceness that there was there. That's all. And then everybody would have got so enthusiastic, and a little while later they would have been in Eretz Yisrael already. And nobody would have had to die, they would all have been there. And all the other tragedies that took place in the desert after this wouldn't have had to have taken place. Moshe Rabbeinu himself would have got there. The whole of history would have been different. The Beis HaMikdash would have been built immediately and never destroyed. Just think of what could have happened had these people come back with that bit of enthusiasm. That is our responsibility, to use our eyes and our presentation ability to inspire enthusiasm. And again, packaging something doesn't mean that you don't realize that there's something inside. Packaging something doesn't mean that you're trying to mislead somebody as to what is inside. All that packaging means is, what I'm giving you now is something special. Look for the good, not only the bad. And where you find the flaw, don't let that spoil the whole thing for you. I'm giving you something precious, something special. Look at the good side of it and see the whole of it. And we need to be able to see life like that. We need to be able to see our family like that. We have to be able to see our friends like that. We have to be able to see our work like that. We have to be able to see our learning like that. We have to be able to see our community like that. We have to be able to see the country like that. We have to be able to see Eretz Yisrael like that. Anything that is important to us, we will only become emotionally enthusiastic about it if we present it correctly to ourselves and to one another. That's an enormous responsibility we have. And to chas v'sholem start presenting things negatively to ourselves and to each other is a most negative, immoral, degenerate thing to be doing. And it's something that regrettably we South African Jews at the moment are doing over and over again, and not only about South Africa, I repeat that. South Africans are becoming negative about everything. Themselves, their lives, their business, the country, Israel, the world, and God too, although they haven't got the guts to say it. But there's no way that they can be separated. A person who's negative is negative about everything. And spreading that negativism is so immoral and so corrupt. We discussed it even in the Beis HaMedrash. You come with a project, you come with an idea, and immediately people finding the flaws in it. What's negative about it? What's negative? What won't work? What isn't right? It's so wrong. It's so harmful. It's so destructive. Take a thing, package it nicely, present it nicely to yourself, present it to others, polish it up, improve it. If there's something wrong with it, try and improve it. If it can't be improved, then that's it. That's the product. That's the object. That's the thing. That's the feeling. Make the best of it. And the first thing you need in order to make the best of it is to be enthusiastic about it. And to be enthusiastic about it, you need to be able to present it properly. And to present it properly, there's got to be an involvement of something that looks nice and something that feels nice. and we have to allow ourselves to acknowledge that feeling, to feel good about what we're doing. Again, whether it's a shiur we've enjoyed, feel good about it. Enjoy it. There's nothing wrong. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah, thou shalt not enjoy learning Torah. Thou shalt not enjoy a shiur. Feel good about it. And let that good bubble over. That's fine. Feel good about your husband, your wife, your children, your parents. Feel good about it. It's okay. And let it bubble over. That's also fine. Feel good about some good things that are taking place in this country. Feel good about some good things that are taking place in Eretz Israel and in the world in general. You'll still see the flaws. But at least it won't spoil everything for you. And more important, it won't spoil everything for everybody else. And if we're able to build ourselves into that kind of person who's able to see that things in that kind of perspective, who's able to turn around a thing and look at it and enjoy it, despite its flaws, despite its shortcomings, just go and enjoy it and see the pleasant side, become attracted to it, be able to be attracted to it visually, and then be attracted to it emotionally, and allow that emotion to overflow and to affect others, we will find that not only don't we suffer a great deal from exaggerating the imperfections, but we will actually be able to turn those imperfections around, and little by little we will be able to improve not only the way we feel about things, but to be able to improve the way things really are.